I did my master's thesis on a study of the production of soft fruits. All by studying cases, legal decisions. Very interesting way to develop any subject. Most of you people are students. You have some feeling about research materials. You pick up some tremendous insights by reading the things that people argue about. Cases, trials, become sort of a history of the society in which you live. One of the nice things about cases is that they're almost always dramatic. People are out there stirring up both sides to get the most color that you can out of it to be persuasive. Yet, isn't it astounding that so few trials that cause a big splash in the newspapers and everyone gets excited about seem to live for very long in people's memories? You take the Sam Shepard affair, which was, do you remember it? Which certainly was not only famous in the United States, but the people in Europe were talking about it. The people in Africa were talking about it. This kind of thing. People traveling around were reporting the interest in this. Yet who's going to know Sam Shepard from the man in the moon a couple of years from now? There are very, very few trials, even those that involve capital offenses, that continue to be exciting and vital, requiring study for many years after they've been decided. How many trials can you name that are more than 50 years old? I suspect you'd come up with a fairly sparse list. Well, there's the Socrates affair. Certainly the Dreyfus affair. Dred Scott in the United States. Maybe a few more. Have I about exhausted them now? And there is the trial that we're going to start talking about tonight, which, of course, is the trial of Christ. The thing that's nice about the trial of Christ is that it is in this select category of cases that have actually maintained their vitality as legal studies. A few years ago, when I was first asked by the LBI people if I'd come out and spend the chapel time talking about the trial of Christ, I wondered whether or not there would be enough really hard legal stuff to justify a whole chapel period. So I went to the library to look, and there's at least a good yard of material sitting down there in the stacks of our library, written by lawyers about the legal study, trial of Christ. The trial as trial has actually maintained enough vitality so that when the new Israel was formed, after the Second World War, an attempt was made to reintroduce the trial of the case of state against Christ for review to see whether or not proper procedures had been followed and whether or not the conviction was an appropriate one. The court did not accept it, I think very wisely, since the evidence obviously is long since passed from all reach except those sources that we all know almost by heart. But the fact remains that still it's a trial that has lived this long. Why? The reasons are really fairly obvious, and that is that in those cases that you can name, Socrates, Dreyfus, Dred Scott, Christ, and a few others that you might be able to think of that are more than a half a century old, you'll find at the bottom of every one of them a political hassle. These things get their vitality and their color out of the fact that they are dramatized history, all caught up and whirling around one pivotal point, one guy, one man, who really personifies for the moment the struggle of a whole nation or a whole group of nations. And what you see there in a microcosm is the beating of this historical development. This is certainly true of the trial of Christ. And the only way that you can possibly hope to understand what really happened here is to take a look at the historical background. Try and get some of the picture of why this man was caught up in the way that he was and why the trial took the shape that it did. Now, with this thought in mind, I'd like to ask two things of you. One is that you forget, if you can, that the defendant in this action is Christ, God. Think of him just as a Jewish man who is on trial for a capital offense, and try to, as unemotionally as possible, analyze the procedure, the evidence, the alleged offense, the verdict, the conduct of the trial, and see whether or not the conviction was appropriate. After all, the world has for many, many years known capital offenses and has executed people, and it's of some value to examine this rather calmly, just as you would any other trial. Disabuse yourself for the moment the idea that Christ is God. Just let him be a defendant in a trial. The other thing is that I would like for you to permit me to separate this into two hunks. It gets long, too long to do a decent job in one evening. Let's figure on something like an hour tonight and then another time to wind it up later in the week at your convenience. I'll meet you anytime you like. Yes. Yes. All right, fine. Well, if there's not another night, by the time you think about it, we'll finish it off tonight if you like. Your time. I hope that some of you are good, sharp students of history. I am working from recollection at this point. My memory is about like that of any normal professor. Apt to get pretty fuzzy, especially in the areas in which I don't teach. So if I come up with a historical blue note once in a while, wiggle your hand. We'll get it straightened out. It's hard to know just exactly where to start when you're trying to figure out a historical puzzle of this sort. Certainly in the case of the trial of Christ, you've got to go back at least a couple thousand years in order to start picking up threads, because it all starts, of course, when the Jewish nation comes into existence. We can get through Abraham and down into Egypt and on the way out of Egypt pretty rapidly without really picking up too much. But once you get outside of Egypt in the Exodus, things start to thicken up pretty rapidly. You've got Moses out in the wilderness with 600,000 men who can bear arms, we're told, perhaps 3 million people, ex-slave people with a very brief culture behind them, and struck first of all by the fact that these people develop a culture very, very fast, almost suspiciously fast. Laws, codes don't come into existence that rapidly. There ought to be a period of centuries, really, for the development of a decent system of jurisprudence. Yet the Hebraic people managed to turn this trick in very short order. But not only that, but it's a rather unusual code they developed. It is not simply a parroting of the Egyptian code. It doesn't even reflect very faithfully the stuff that came out of the Far East. Hammurabi, one of the great lawgivers, certainly of the ancient world, but this is not that pattern of law either. Rather, it is a whole new type of legal pattern that the Jewish people spell out that has a type of humane quality in it that the world has never known before in a judicial system. This becomes important in this review for the very simple reason that it's hard under such a body of law to convict a man of a capital offense. If you think of relatively recent days in England, where as many as 200 offenses were punishable by death, and contrast that against this early Hebraic period, where about a dozen offenses were punishable by death, you begin to get some of the picture. Plus the fact that the cards were all stacked in favor of the defendant in a Jewish trial. By the time that Christ was tried and the laws were written out in detail, and we of course still have these laws to look at and read, you see that it's extremely difficult to convict a man of an offense which calls for death. The Jewish people simply did not like to execute one of their number. Imprisonment, yes. Other kinds of punishment, yes. But the cards were all stacked in favor of the defendant. Even so much so that when they did, on those rare occasions, find a man guilty of death and order that he be executed, and start the procession out to the place where the execution would be carried out, if he or anyone else thought of any reason why they ought to go back and start the trial over again, this was available to them. In fact, a man was kept on horseback, and a flag was run up a pole. And if that flag ever dropped, the messenger on horseback would immediately be sent out to intercept the party and bring them back to the judgment hall again, because somebody would have thought of something they hadn't handled yet. I'll talk about that a little bit later, probably the next time we meet, about the procedure. The point that I want to get across to you right now is the humane quality which the Jewish people had built into their law, which made it extremely difficult to get a conviction in a capital case. The other thing that happened out there in the wilderness as Moses was leading the children through the desert, apparently, though scholars, I suppose, will debate this for a long time, it's apparently the Sanhedrin started developing. And Moses, as you know, had his hands full. It's an awful lot of people to be booting around the desert with. And if you go back to the 11th chapter of Numbers, take a look at it sometime, you'll see Moses sitting out there in his tent sort of muttering to himself about all the problems he has. His father-in-law, Moses married a girl from the wilderness. His father-in-law was in residence for part of the time, about as helpful as most in-laws are. And in effect, the father-in-law says to Moses, "Boy, you've got holes in your head. What you need is a judicial system. Somebody's got to help you judge these cases. When the people line up outside your tent in long rows, there's no use sitting in here growling about it, and get organized." Moses talked this over with God, and God then instructed Moses, the 11th chapter of Numbers, "Call to yourself 70 of the leaders of the people, and I will take part of the spirit which I have put upon you, and I will put it upon them, that they may help you carry these burdens of decisions and judgments in the operation of the Jewish people." Now, this may or may not have been the Sanhedrin as we know it later, but the Sanhedrin in Christ's time was 70 people plus the high priest. It maintained this same form. It's a rather interesting observation that the Jewish system knew the Sanhedrin in three forms, really. It had this body, the great Sanhedrin, 70, and these guys, every one of them, sharp as a tack. You can look at the requirements set out, a knowledge of the language all about them, complete familiarity of the law of their own people, people of high repute, high scholarship, and so forth. This was the Supreme Court for the Jewish people. Then there was what was known as the Minor Sanhedrin, which was composed of 30 people. It was kind of a circuit court or an intermediate court. It met in several different cities throughout the country at the time that Christ lived. And then there was the JP, the least Sanhedrin. That was three members of the court. The Jewish people never had a single-man court, never handled a judicial problem with less than three judges aboard. It gives you an insight, too, on the kind of law that these people had developed by this time. It's rather amazing. As the children of Israel came out of the desert and into the Promised Land, this development went forward, of course, and we can skip down through the period of the kings, David and Solomon, without stopping here very long, and get into the period of captivity, when the kingdom came unglued, the north and the south, after their civil war, and they were picked up and carried away by the Babylonians. Because at this point, the threads really start to take on some real bulk in putting together what makes up the background of this trial. It was about at this period, when the prophets were writing, that intense scholarly reflection was going on in the Jewish people. You see, things had gone badly all of a sudden. There was the Pentateuch back there, the law, which made it pretty clear that the Jewish people were the chosen people and that God looked after them specially. And now things didn't seem to be going that way, and it was obvious that somebody had misread the book. And the scholars had to get down to this thing and try and figure out what it really was all about. This kind of necessity, which produced for us the written prophecies in the Old Testament, was the basis upon which the scholarship of the Jew really developed. The rabbi, the scribe, the teacher, developed during this period and carried through, indeed, through all the history of the Jewish world, still to this day. Of course, the rabbi is a man who has this sort of esteem. But in this period, the time of the few hundred years before the trial of Christ and up to the trial itself, the rabbi, the teacher, the scribe, this guy, was the authority on everything. He was the man that knew when to plant the crops and what to do for torn ligaments and what the answer was to religious problems. He was the man. Josephus, the Jewish scholar, says that the prestige of the rabbi at this time was so great that if a rabbi should stand up and tell the people that the left hand was the right hand and the black was white, nobody would even question him. Everybody knew that there was a special place in heaven for rabbis. Their authority was absolutely undisputed. They had this kind of background. And here you get one of the groups of people who become extremely influential at the time that Christ lived. And as we shall see the next time we meet, Christ really tees off his public ministry by lining the scribes up against the wall and saying to people, unless your righteousness exceeds that you see out there, pull the plug and give up. Because there you have a grand accumulation of nothing. And he's off to a good offensive type of ministry. It may have been at the end of the Babylonian period, the time that the Persians took over, Cyrus, Darius, that another party started forming in the Jewish history. Here again, this one is sort of clouded up in history that we have not been able to unravel completely to satisfaction, but it was either then or immediately after the children started coming back to the land of Judea that the Sadducees started emerging as a recognizable group within Jewish history. And this bunch you simply have to tag and get a good hard look at them for what they were. The Sadducees were, of course, a traditional priestly class of persons. They would be, in modern vocabulary, pretty much the politicians of the group. They were the ones who had ambassadors' skills. They were able to work with anyone who happened to be in the saddle at the moment. They worked fine with the Babylonians. They worked great with the Persians. After they got home, they worked fine with the Greeks. They were still going strong with the Romans. They had political skills. They were willing to adapt their way of life to whatever was going on. It also made them sort of a cynical group in a lot of ways. Sadducees, as you probably know, never accepted as canonical anything except the first five books of the Bible. They never accepted the prophets, anything after the Pentateuch, as being really the revealed word of God. As a result, there were some pretty sharp theological differences between the Sadducees and the other groups that formed in the Jewish nation. For example, the resurrection of the body is mentioned nowhere in the first five books. And the Sadducee never accepted a life after death. He never accepted the concept of resurrection at all. He was also the man who learned, or the party which learned, to keep itself in power, although a minority party, managed to keep itself in the power by having a real keen appreciation of what a denarii can do for a man. Undoubtedly a lot of corruption, graft, bribery, this sort of thing. They took over the tax collecting scheme by and large. Foreign nation ruled. They needed somebody locally to handle the tax collection. There was always a Sadducee willing to pop out. I don't mean to say that they had a monopoly on it. They were just there faster with more skills than most other people. Once they got back into the land of Jerusalem itself, the Sadducees took over control of the temple, and they managed to maintain it, largely by financial influence, from that time right on through the time of the trial that we're talking about. This meant that they maintained their control. Well, for example, Annas, Caiaphas, five other members of the same family on the Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin at the time of the trial. These people simply lined up, the old man and all his sons and sons-in-laws, one after another, became the high priests. There were five that we know of in this same family that became the high priests. Every one of them purchased the robes. It's the way they got there. Josephus seems to be perfectly clear on this. Doesn't bother him a bit. Where do they get the money? Well, part of it I've indicated already. The rest of it is that they were the ones who had the animals for sale for sacrifices in the temple. If you wanted to buy a dove or sheep or an oxen, you bought it from a Sadducee. If you happened to be from out of the nation and didn't have the right kind of Hebrew coin in your pocket, and you wanted to change the currency of your homeland, Egypt or whatever it was, into the proper Jewish half shekel, you went to the money changer's temple in the temple to get a kosher coin. And of course, each one of these things was accompanied by a markup and a profit. This is the source of the Sadducees' power. Now, I take it that you begin to see the kind of picture that develops here. The man who was the defendant in the trial, shortly before he was brought on for trial, allegedly brought one Lazarus back from the death. A horribly embarrassing incident, if it happened, for the Sadducees. It whacked their theology going leftwise. And then he rushed into the temple, chased out all of the people who were changing money, and knocked out the guys who were selling animals. When you hit a man in his pocketbook, you're hitting him in a place where you get a real reflex. And you begin to get the picture, you see. The Sadducees, as a group, simply could not stand this sort of disparagement of their theology and their economics both coming and going. And we'll illustrate that quite a bit more with some scriptures and some instances from scripture when we meet again. I'll give you a number of citations to look at to sharpen up your perception of what was going on there. All right, so the children of Israel are now back home in the promised land. The Persians are very shortly out of the picture. This is the time of Alexander the Great. The Greeks, 331, thereabouts. Alexander, with his brief lifespan going through the country, rapidly taking over everything from the western part of the world that we know, the peninsula of Greece, going all the way east, all the way over to India, picking up, of course, the Holy Land. I don't know whether Alexander was would ever have handled things the way that they worked out, but he died a very young man, as you know. And when he died, his kingdom got split into five parts, three of which we can ignore very quickly. This was a division among the five generals who had carried the burden for Alexander. The ones that we know best from our secular history are, of course, the Ptolemies, the PTO types, down south, running over into Egypt and coming up into the lower half of Judea, and the Seleucids, a general by that name, and his followers coming from the north and down almost to where the Ptolemies were on the south. There was a relatively small hunk of Judea left in the middle as a buffer zone. And of course, this was typical of the whole history of the Jewish people throughout all of their experience. They always were a buffer for somebody. Even during the time of the expansion of King David, you see this same phenomenon at work, where the Persians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians had beaten each other to the ground. They'd all gone back to their own corners to puff for a few years. And here with a complete power vacuum in the world, the West hadn't even shaken itself out of its lethargy yet. But the three great powers in the world, having beaten each other literally to a standstill, everybody had gone home to regroup and build some more atomic bombs. And here comes David rushing out into a vacuum, and suddenly he looks like a very great man indeed. I don't mean to say that he isn't. This is true, of course, in almost all political battles in the world, that the Napoleons have rushed into a vacuum someplace and have occupied the territories. This is what David did. Well, Alexander the Great does this in part. And on his death, his empire immediately starts to fall apart. it very soon became a sort of an eyeball-to-eyeball contest between Ptolemies and Seleucids. And the place where they chose to meet and fight it out was Judea, because this is the conflicting battle zone between the two. Before very long, the Ptolemies, who originally were in control, lost. And the people, the Greeks from the north, took over. They made a pretty bad political mistake at about this time, because it's at this point that we get into the book of Daniel. Daniel, as you know, was written almost too late to make the canon, the Old Testament. It barely got in there at the tail end of it. And the thing that Daniel is describing is this period in history, because the Greeks decided to Hellenize, to make Greeks religiously, socially, politically, ethnically as they could out of the people that they mastered. And so they started to try and change the Jews' religion. They should have been smarter. People have been trying that for a couple thousand years practically by this time. After we're all down now to just a couple hundred years before Christ, you see, 300, to be a little bit more accurate, 250, 300 years before the birth of Christ. And the desolation of abomination that Daniel talks about, the attempt to force by murder, torture, other means, to force the Jew to accept the Greek way of life, simply brought the bristles up on the Jewish citizen. And these guys, who after all were second raters, Alexander was dead and gone by this time, simply couldn't bring it off. Didn't have what it took. And the Jews began to get themselves more or less in shape for a good fight in war. And pretty soon a family by the name of the Maccabees appeared on the Jewish scene. Maccabeans, translated into history, I understand this would be the hammerers. Hammerers, sort of like a hammer shield in our own day, you see. That's a happy translation for our purposes here. They started hammering away at the Jewish structure. 164, down to about 140 years before the birth of Christ. And they had actually driven by military strength to the place where they had shoved the Greeks back. Now, I hasten to add that the Greeks were pooed out, frayed away, divided, weren't what they used to be anymore. Nonetheless, the fact remains that the Maccabean influence at this point actually drove the boundaries of the Jewish empire back just about the same area that David held at the very peak of the 1000 BC, the golden era of the Jew. We overlook this quite frequently when we think about Jewish history for the very simple reason that it wasn't a very golden age for the Jew. They were torn by every conceivable sort of internal stress. It was during this period that the party of the Pharisees took on recognizable shape. Never a very large party. It's been estimated that they probably never ran over 5,000 or 6,000 people at one time. They were the it's even hard to think of a good name for them. They were the technical people. In a sense, they were the pietists of the Jewish crowd, and the pietists in the bad sense now. Everything had to be done just exactly according to the book, and you know all about this. People who wore the phylacteries and made the hems of their garments long and stood on the street corners and made show. They were influential. They did not cooperate at all with foreign powers. They were here almost completely opposite from the Sadducees. In fact, the Pharisees were willing to and did pay special fines rather than cooperate on government projects. And they made quite a show out of it, too. As soon as the Greeks had been shoved out of the area occupied by the Jewish people, the Pharisees and the Sadducees had at one another. Not just intellectually, but by physical combat. And soon the whole nation of the Jew was torn up by internal fighting. Josephus says of this period that although the Greeks managed to kill a fantastic number of Jews, that it was nothing like the slaughter that occurred from one Jew killing the other. when one nation collapses, another nation rises, as we've already seen, to occupy the power position. And of course, in this instance, it was the Roman government, the fullness of time beginning to build up over here. If you've ever seen one of these histomaps of the world's powers, as they're called, where they graph out the blocks of influence of the various nations in the world, you will be struck by the sudden bulge of the Roman power out here. And that's exactly what was happening. The Romans were not looking for trouble with the Greeks at the shallow end of the Mediterranean. They were not particularly interested in that. They were down in Africa. They pulled an end run around the north end and got way over into Syria, Persia, over toward India. They didn't bother at first the area that we know as the Holy Land, the land of Judea and so forth. However, as things went from bad to worse in the Holy Land, and as the internal struggles got so bloody and fierce that there really wasn't any effective government left at all, that is, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, partly because of theological differences. Sadducees accepted only the first five books. Pharisees took the whole thing, had all sorts of arguments here. Partly because of political differences, the Sadducees were always trying to make a deal with somebody. I mean, another nation, form a treaty, Pharisees having none of this at all. A whole bunch of reasons working here. The Romans saw the Judean situation as being a real threat to world peace. It was sort of a North Vietnam, and something had to be done about it. And so Pompey, a ruler of Rome, went in to set matters at rest. And this was, of course, about 60 years or so, 65 perhaps, before the birth of Christ. Pompey went in, and after one tremendous military struggle, he almost united the Jews. After a rather tremendous military struggle, he brought them to the knees and set up a form of control. The interesting thing about the Roman as a conqueror in world history was that insofar as possible, he tried to use the structure that the people had already set up to govern themselves. Wherever an efficient form of government was operating, the Romans would simply take it over, reserve a few things for themselves, and let these people run the internal affairs of the country. Of course, the tax money went back to Rome, was farmed out, as other countries did in these days, and certain prerogatives of Roman citizenship remained for the Romans to decide for themselves. But by and large, the local legislative process, the local judiciary process, went on. As the Romans looked at the situation in Israel, they probably went through some sort of evaluation of how they ought to handle this thing. And they decided to try and do it with a local man. If you want to look, those of you who brought your Bible with you, at the account in Luke, just very quickly, you can pick up some of this flavor. Second chapter of Luke would be an awfully good place to start, first verse. In those days, it says, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. And this was the first enrollment when Quirinius was the governor of Syria. You know where Syria is. And the part that I want to pick up for you here is the fact that the Romans had opted, in the case of those big boys over there, the old Babylonian Persian empires, and they did the same thing down in Africa, the Egyptian empires, and the powers that really were dangerous, that were really a threat to the Roman government, they moved in a Roman procurator, a governor, their man on the scene, and they took over the direct reins of government at once, and that's what they were doing east of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem, after all, was a pretty small potato, as world powers go. And the Romans didn't think that it was necessary to set up a Roman procurator immediately to rule directly from Rome, but rather they were willing to take their chances on local government of some sort. If you look at chapter 3 for a moment, you get some dating of when all of this is going on. This is Luke again, chapter 3. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate became governor of Judea. Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Etruria, and so forth. Now you see, this, now we're talking about the time when Christ's ministry is about to start. And we have shifted from local rule by a king, Herod the Great, down to a procurator, Pontius Pilate, governor, and another tetrarch, which is called Herod here. And I think we better get these guys unscrambled right away so we begin to see the picture. First, let's back up and be sure that we know where we stand politically up to this point. We have a group of guys who are top dogs in the whole structure, scribes, Pharisees. The scribes, the rabbis, the teachers. They are not a single political party, but rather they belong to any of the parties. This is a position, a rank, rather than a political affiliation. Then there were the Sadducees. You've got them figured out. They're the politicians. There were the Pharisees. These are the non-cooperators, technical legalism boys. And, of course, there were a couple others that we have to recognize. The adherents of Maccabean thought, the zealots, the militarists, were still in large number floating around. In fact, you know, when Luther got to the Diet of Worms, he undoubtedly met some of the descendants of these particular people we're talking about in the zealots right now, because when the Romans came in to take over, Pompey came in to take over, he picked up a number of what we would call Hessian troops. It's a little bit of irony in that, who were the zealots, the militarists, the Maccabeans, the hardened, trained military men out of Jerusalem, and ran them right up into our ancestral, well, mine at least, Germany, right up as paid mercenary troops. He used the Jew, who by this time was thoroughly conditioned and a rather excellent fighter. This was done, of course, in part to weaken the structure of the Jewish nation and try and get them bled down to the place where they wouldn't have the military strength to pull a coup if they got the opportunity. So there were still these people, the zealots. It took on really the form of a force, a political force. And finally, of course, there were the group that we are just really learning about now, the Essenes. We've known for a long time that they were there. We're finding out a lot more about them now. They really were the purists in this picture. They pulled out of town altogether. They'd have nothing to do with politics, and they'd have nothing to do with legalism. They yanked themselves out, built essentially monastic settings in the edge of town, apparently did not marry, no children, apparently, in some of these, most of these groups, in fact. They became the Lutheran Welfare Family and Child Societies of their day, handled orphans. And it's a rather interesting thing, and also significant to the trial of Christ, to speculate a little bit about whether or not the Essenes played in much more directly than we might think. Because if John the Baptist's parents were anywhere near as old as Scripture makes them out, after all, we are told that the father, he was as good as dead, and the mother was right next to it even before John was born. And if this is true, you see, John the Baptist must have become an orphan at a very early age. Maybe she got housing with some of the relatives, but apparently not with Christ. Because when Christ came out to be baptized, you look at the version in John, the Gospel of, where John the Baptist is referring to this man who's coming after him. He says, "I didn't know him." Recognize him, you know who he was. Well, that's kind of funny talk for a man who's a cousin, especially if he grew up with him. Plus the fact that this John the Baptist looked like an Essene. He wore clothes like the Essenes wore. He ate the kind of food that they wore. He held many of the beliefs that they apparently held. And when somebody looks, walks, acts, talks, and smells like one, chances are that pretty good he was one, you see. Now, I don't know whether this is true or not. I have no way of making my case except for the rather sketchy evidence that I've been pointing to. If so, it adds an awfully nice little thread running through this thing. Because when John the Baptist came crawling out of the woodwork, one of the first things that he hit, and that he hit left and right, as you well know, he was not a soft-spoken gentleman, was Herod. This is not Herod the Great. This is another one, Herod Antipas. It's the man before whom Christ ultimately appeared. Herod had been up to no good. He had just married his brother's wife, his half-brother's wife. And John came like a fox out of the north, you know. He says, this is a very unkingly sort of thing that you're doing here, and I don't approve of it. And the wife, Herodias, flew into an absolute rage. She wanted the guy's head. She didn't get it, not then, not right away, which is a very interesting insight on the kind of kingdom that this guy Herod was running at the moment. He was afraid to execute at that point one poor little old moth-eaten prophet because of the unrest in his own domain. And it wasn't until later, when Herodias got the king in a good mood after watching Salome dance a bit, and probably after a few too many drinks, that she actually did bring off the execution of John the Baptist, had the head delivered, as you recall. And this is followed further by, a little while later, people are telling Christ, you know what happened to John? Herod's after you. Get out of here. He's going to come. And then we get this very interesting response which Christ makes to Herod. Herod is actually demanding an audience. And Christ tells the messenger, you go back and you tell that fox. It's the words that he uses. Not exactly a kingly nomination at this point. You go back and tell that fox that the Son of Man is going to stay here today, tomorrow, and the next day. When my work's done, I'm leaving. And this is the way to handle a king. This is another man who ultimately judges Christ when we get to the trial. But I'm slightly out of sequence now. We're back to the place where Pompey has come in. We're in the 60s. The Greeks are gone. The election has been made to set up a local government rather than put a procurator or a Roman governor immediately in charge of the area. Now the problem is to select a man who will do a good job of governing, who won't be too favorable toward the local people, and still will be have enough of the local flavor so that he will be acceptable to them. The man that was chosen for the job was, of course, Herod the Great, the one that we call Herod the Great. The Jews called him Herod the Bloody, with very good reason. He was the third in a line of people that we can take back. The grandfather was a man who had helped Rome invade Egypt. And in return for that, the grandfather had been, Herod Antipater, had been given a kingdom down in this part of the world. And now his grandson is set up by Rome to be the king of the area. He was an Edomite. You, of course, all remember all about the Edomites. But just to be occupying some time, I'll tell you about it in a way. The Edomites were descendants of Esau. And those what descended from Esau didn't have too much use for those who descended from Jacob. Jacob, of course, yes. Still doesn't sound right. Must be getting late. And at the time, again, of the Exodus, see, they had settled, the Edomites had settled down below the Holy Land in the area which was traversed in part by the children of Israel after they came out. When Moses was coming out, he did the sensible thing. He took the direct route. He skirted the Philistines over here by the water. They had steel weapons. He didn't want any part of them. He didn't want to get way over into the desert over there. And so he started up directly north from Egypt, across the Sea of Reeds, going up directly north to get into the Promised Land. It would have been a short, sweet trip. It's the kind of trip that you would have made. And they are fresh out of Egypt, not even any good armaments yet at the time of all this takes place. They're not yet a fighting people. They don't have 40 years of toughening up in the wilderness behind them yet. Couldn't even handle a small wall at this point in their development. Joshua is a long way away yet in his military strength. So they very politely go up to the Edomites, and they say, "We'd like passage through your country because we're going over there." And the Edomites said, "Maybe you've forgotten who we are descended from and who you're descended from. The answer to your question is no. Can't go through our kingdom." And Moses' messengers then said, "Look, we'll promise good conduct. We'll go right straight through on the highways. We won't go to the left, we won't go to the right. We won't eat your crops, we won't steal your sheep, and we won't pursue your women. Right straight through. No trouble, no bother at all." And the Edomites said, "No, you can't." Now, 1,500 years later, when the Romans want to pick out a man to rule as king, after taking over Judea, they pick out Herod, an Edomite. Not only because of the political spoils system which is operating here, but also because he's a guy who isn't going to buddy up too much with the people who have been causing the real fuss, the Jewish nation. He's a guy, you see, who won't sympathize too much with these people. Plus the fact that he married a Samaritan. That's a lovely combination. Edomites to the left and Samaritans to the right. And you can't lose on that one. Herod was Herod the Great was a very cruel man. He was also a lecherous bum. He managed to keep order, all right, mostly because the Jews were tired after the fight with the Romans, I suspect. Pretty well bled white at the moment. And Herod staggered through almost to the end of his career without anything really serious happening to him. But as he began to get feeble toward the end of his life, the zealots started becoming quite active again, and little insurrections were popping up all over the place. Word got out one day that Herod had died, and general rejoicing broke out among the Jews. They even rushed the temple and took down some of the images that he'd put up there, mostly despite the Jewish people. This group of people were led by two of the favorite rabbis in Jerusalem at that time. Herod was not yet quite dead. He had them brought down to Caesarea, where he was living at that time. Herod was a big spender, if nothing else. He had built a tremendous palace for himself in Caesarea, and he built the big Antonio up in Jerusalem. Lots of other things, too. He was free with other people's money. It's one of the things that the Jewish people actually resented. Fact is, it's rather interesting that Herod was one of the big spenders for the Olympic Games in these days. He thought it would do the Jewish people some find a lot of good if they got the publicity that came with picking up the bill for some of the Olympic Games. You know, in some of Paul's epistles, he refers to this sort of thing. Some of the people that Paul calls the generous donors in his letters in the New Testament, you take that word back to where it starts. It's the guy who picks up the bills for athletic contests. It's a way in which you made friends, you see. And Herod was never slow on the draw when he was spending the Jewish money. Well, he wasn't quite dead. So he had these two rabbis brought down to Caesarea, and he was literally carried out on a cot to judge them. And he managed to stay alive long enough to see him roasted alive. Now, this didn't up his popularity standing with the Jewish people at all, because these rabbis were probably the favored persons in Jerusalem at that time. And Herod realized that he wasn't long for this world, and that when he actually did die, there would be all kinds of trouble. So he instructed his sister, who also was named Salome, another one, to round up and corral 100 of the primary leaders of the Jewish people and keep them in close security. And on the day when Herod did die, she was supposed to have all of them executed immediately. Two reasons. One was to take the effective leadership out of the Jewish insurrection, which would almost certainly be attempted at his death, you see. And the other reason was to cut down the general hilarity in the community. You killed that many leaders, why, people wouldn't be hurrahing quite so much. She was smart enough not to try it, incidentally. Herod left a will. It was a new will. He had written it in the last month of his life. His first will had provided that his kingdom be divided among children of his first wife, And he had had a falling out with them along toward the end of his career, mostly because they were trying to accelerate his date of departure. They had poisoned some food which was intended for the old boy, and fortunately or unfortunately, as things go, it had been short-stopped by some other people who died before Herod got around to eating of it. And this burned Herod no end. It was hardly the kind of treatment that a father ought to get from his children, and so he asked Caesar whether or not he might execute the lads, and Caesar said, sure, it's what he'd do under the circumstances. And so Herod killed his oldest sons, who would have been his legitimate heirs, and made a new will. In this new will, he divided his kingdom really into four segments and then grouped two of them. And he provided in his will that the property should in effect be divided into three parts. One of these parts would go to a son by his wife, whose name I've forgotten. You probably didn't know her anyway. The boy's name was Philip. The other parts would go to a son by the name of Antipas, Herod Antipas, is the one that we know. And the big chunk, the two quarters, one half, would go to a boy by the name of Archelaus. I guess that's the way you pronounce it, Archelaus. This was provided for in his will. Now, the location of these portions of the kingdom becomes rather significant at this point. The big part, the part that was to go to Archelaus, is the area that we know primarily as Judea, the out on the seacoast down around Jerusalem, the nice heartland there. The part which was to go to Philip was the stranger in this crowd. The other two boys were brothers. Philip was by yet another wife. They were half-brothers. Philip was the half-brother of Archelaus and Antipas. His mother's name was Cleopatra. I remember that. It's not the one that you know, though. It's another wife of Herod the Great. Philip was to get the territory which was lying east of the Jordan River, not really in the Jewish land itself, but another people, a foreign people, not the people of the promise. So Philip is essentially, for our purposes, out of this picture now. His kingdom is going to be on the other side of the Jordan. The other quarter, which was to go to Herod Antipas, A-N-T-I-P-A-S, and he's the one that really gets through to meet Christ, was divided into two parts. One part of it was right across the Jordan River from the part that Philip had, thus just on the west side of the Jordan River, the part known as Perea. And then up north, there was a hunk called Galilee. And that was to be the other part of Herod Antipas' kingdom. You have heard of a tetrarch. You also know what tetra is, quarters, fourths. These guys weren't kings. They were quarter kings, except Archelaus, who was an ethnarch. And he had it coming and going, see. When they died, when Herod the Great finally died, the boys immediately got into a squabble, apparently touched off by Herodias. Herodias was a niece of Herod Antipas. There's more interrelation here than even the English kings managed to come up with. She was the wife of Philip, half-brother of Herod Antipas. And she was an ambitious gal, if nothing else. And she, you can just see her sort of poking Philip's in the ribs and saying, look, Philip, let's take off for Rome. The will is not valid until Caesar approves it. And let's get over there and explain a few things to him, why you are much more fit to rule than either Archelaus or Antipas, and maybe we can pick up your pop's whole kingdom and make you a king rather than just a tetrarch. So off they went to Rome to contest the will. It's one of the first early, really interesting will contest cases in history. And incidentally, we have the argument of counsel in that case pretty well preserved for us. Very, very articulate people who were speaking for these boys when they got to Rome. Well, of course, when Antipas and Archelaus heard about this, zoom, they're off to Rome too. If there's going to be a lawsuit over Dad's will, they better be there to see to it that justice was done. Now, you got the picture? Herod the Great has just died. He had enough trouble while he was still living. Control was supposed to be taken over right away by the other three boys. They're all in Rome, squabbling over the fortune. Guess what's happening back in Jerusalem? Well, this is obviously, the place just came unglued. The militarists, the zealots, were all over the place, just wham, like this. Caesar's man in Syria, the procurator, used to be Quirinius, that we read about. This guy, the man who was procurator at this time, was known as Varus, V-A-R-U-S. And he got the reports about all the difficulty that was arising over there in this area that was now a tributary of Roman power. So Varus picked up the Roman legions and off he marched for the land of Judea. And he quelled the riots and sent word to Caesar, "What do you want me to do now?" Caesar lined up Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip and said, "Boy, if there's anything I hate, it's guys who goof off on the job. You guys don't look like kings to me. I don't know whether I'll approve your father's will or not, or whether I'll put a Roman governor in there right smack." Well, Archelaus, Antipas, Philip decided that they could demonstrate that they would be good after this. And they also had an ace up their sleeve. Herod the Great, whatever else he was not stupid. When he wrote his will, he wrote into his will an extremely generous gift to the Emperor of Rome. If the emperor refused to find that the will was a valid one, he didn't pick up the dice. If he found that the will was valid, he got his own bequest, and the boys got their kingdoms. Not a bad move, actually. Well, probably totally uninfluenced by this, Caesar decided that the will was valid, and he sent the boys back to their various kingdoms. This was about, just about the time of the birth of Christ. See, we know that Christ was born still during the reign of Herod the Great. Herod the Great died in 4 B.C. That's a historically known fact. Therefore, Christ was born at least 4 years before the birth of Christ. Before the turn of what we call the A.D. period. Probably born about 7 A.D., although this cannot be really determined too accurately. Archelaus came back. He lasted about 3.5 years. He simply wasn't man enough for the job. The Jewish people took him, and they took him good. He couldn't control it, and it soon became obvious to the emperor that Archelaus could not rule his kingdom, so he removed him. And having had quite enough of this inefficiency and trouble out of the land of Judea, the emperor decided to put in a Roman governor, rule direct now, rather than stumble around anymore with indirect rule in this area. And this became the first one of the series that ultimately produced Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurators in Judea, lived in Caesarea. It's where they ruled, and they traveled into Jerusalem on special occasions. Christ was before the fifth of the line of seven of these guys. The last point I want to make tonight is this. When the Roman emperor decided to put in a governor, this meant that he changed the entire political complexion of the land of Israel. Because by having a Roman garrison, a Roman governor, directly in this heartland, it made it pretty tough on the zealots to stick around and foment revolutions under the nose of the Roman governor. This left them two choices. They could go across the Jordan River into alien territory and live under Philip. Only Philip turned out to be a pretty good guy. He turned out to be a fellow who had quite a bit of savvy about ruling. He's far and away the best of these boys, ran the best government. And he wasn't buying any of this. He didn't want any foreigners coming across the Jordan River and into his kingdom. So everybody went north. They went into the home of Herod Antipas, the area that he ruled, that being the logical place. So what Herod Antipas inherited out of all of this was not only a hunk of real estate, but also just about every ambulatory zealot that was in Israel at this time. That's why a little bit later, when Christ starts his ministry, and you know, of course, that all of Christ's disciples but one came out of Galilee. When people would say, well, this man is from Galilee, the general reaction was sort of to tear your hair and say, can anything good come out of that area? Because this is the place where all of the military insurrections got started. Well, this then is essentially the political picture. You have Christ coming on the scene at a time when Herod Antipas has already been pretty well alienated because of the John the Baptist affair and because of the snub which Christ had given him. You have the Sadducees backed off in a corner, being terribly worried about their control and actually working very closely as they can with a Roman governor now, and trying to maintain the lines of authority through him, preserving as much of the Sanhedrin's power, the Sanhedrin being both legislature and court. The Roman procurator, you see, had immediately taken over control of the Sanhedrin. Anybody who wanted to be high priest bought his robes back from the Roman governor, and this made it doubly necessary to have the income. The Pharisees, the Essenes out in the sticks, and the militarists laying up supplies against the better day. This then is the place where we can stop for tonight. And the next time we meet, please do bring your Bibles with you, or at least your New Testaments. And we'll be picking up the citations as to how Christ manages, the defendant in the action, manages in rapid fire order to alienate each one of these parties and get himself into an ongoing political hassle that simply had to terminate in some sort of a blow-up at the end of a very short time. So we'll pick it up there next hour.